Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Champions League Takeaway here on Ranks FC, your roundup of all the action in the Champions League from Tuesday's second legs in the round of 16. And we have our first four quarter finalists. Real Madrid are through to the quarterfinals after beating Manchester City 2-1 on the night at the Etihad, 5-1 on aggregate. PSG, the reigning champions, are through comfortably to the quarterfinals after an 8-2 aggregate victory over Chelsea, 3-0 on the night at Stamford Bridge. Arsenal are into the quarterfinals. A 2-0 win over Bayer Leverkusen means it's 3-1 to them on aggregate. And Sporting win 5-0 to end the Bordeaux Glimt fairy tale. 5-3 on aggregate, and what a start to the evening. An incredible performance. Wow. We'll come on to that game. My name's Jack Collins, and I'll be your host today. And joining me across the water, you've heard him already, is the one and only Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
Yeah, sorry, I couldn't resist. That was painful for Bordeaux, wasn't it? Fairy tales don't exist after all. Bless him. That's a hard one to take. We'll talk about it in a little bit. But yeah, mate, look, people who thought that this version of the Champions League was going to be boring definitely hasn't been, as it, when you start to read those out, it's like 5-1, 8-2, and it's like, wow. Yeah, and the Premier League really, really being put in its place at the moment, and can't really have any complaints over the course of the two games that we've seen for both Man City and Chelsea. Although I will say that Man City did give this a better go than it perhaps looks on paper.
Yeah, well, let's get into it, shall we? Let's start with that one. And it's a funny one because, you know, obviously the way that the game pans out when Man City come out really hot, right? Like they open up really well and they create a load of chances and they really should be in the lead. But the game remains at 0-0. And then there is the moment where the whole tie probably hinges and Bernardo Silva blocks the ball on the line. He moves his arm across. He's trying to get his chest across, but it hits his arm. It's clearly a handball. It's clearly a red card. It's clearly a penalty. As long as the offside isn't given, City are down to 10. And then they're 1-0 down. And then they're 4-0 down on aggregate. And you don't really see any way back into it for them. But actually, over the course of 90 minutes, I thought City genuinely acquitted themselves well in this one.
They actually did. And I thought it was fitting that their fans were pretty noisy at the end. They were singing, "We love you, City," making sure that the players knew that they were with them. Obviously, heading into a huge game at the weekend, a cup final against Arsenal. And there was a sense of togetherness in that moment from the City fans that had stayed behind after watching the full 90. And I think actually it's right, because they can take a sense of pride from this one. I mean, look, Madrid could have been 1-0 up in this one in 1 minute. Valverde, again, the man who had the chance. And this time, City were let off the hook. But it was a pretty frantic start to the game. But ultimately, you know, City were doing well over the course of the first half. Thibaut Courtois was forced to make at least four good saves. But ultimately, it was the Bernardo Silva red card on 20 minutes that turns it. It was always going to be hard to come back from it. I mean, I do have sympathy for Bernardo. I mean, ultimately, in the Champions League, there's going to be no other outcome than a penalty and a red card here. But, you know, what is he actually supposed to do? Like, he's back trying to block his goal, right? He's trying to defend his goal. He's basically on the goal line. And Vinicius Jr. is hitting a shot goalbound towards where he is standing. And he's got his hands behind his back. And think about how hard this ball is also being hit, by the way. It's all very well looking at it in slow motion to see where it hit. Think about how hard Vinny's actually hitting this and how fast the moment is coming. And all Bernardo Silva does is lean himself towards the direction of the ball with his hands generally behind his back. He's done all he can to just try to keep the ball out fairly. And the ball does hit his arm and go wide, the top just beneath his shoulder. So yeah, it's a penalty. But what? It's a red card. But what is he supposed to do? He can't disappear. He can't get out of the way so that the ball goes in. Like, what's his manager going to think if Bernardo Silva like ducks or dives out of the way so the ball goes straight in? I don't know what he's supposed to do.
There's,
it's weird,
there's
isn't
a little
it?
Bit of there's a little bit of fortune associated with this. Let's say Bernardo Silva is like 1-2 yards to the right of where he's standing, right? And imagine that ball ricochets off the same part of his arm and goes into the back of the net. It's still 1-0 to Real Madrid, but there's no red card because the goal goes in, right? And so in that regard, I suppose it's a bit unfortunate, but also like this isn't, I know it's not you either. That's not to say that the decision isn't right. It is right. But equally, it just feels like one of those ones that is just incredibly harsh in the manner in which it's given. It doesn't mean the decision is wrong. It doesn't mean it shouldn't be a red card. It doesn't mean it shouldn't be a penalty. Like, everything is followed correctly here. It's just one of those ones that feels a little bit like, oh, my heart. And also the first red card of Bernardo Silva's career, I believe.
Is it? I'm like, there should be a common sense rule. And the ref should be like, everyone, can we agree that I should show some common sense here? Like, players come around. Can I let him stay on? Like, he tried his best. Look, watch the replay. And then see what the vote is. Do that instead of a VAR. Because it's ridiculous, really. Anyway, it doesn't matter. He got the red card. Vinny steps up, converts the penalty. It's 1-0/4-0 to Real Madrid. Couple of minutes later, you know, Pep Guardiola gets a yellow card. You can see Pep getting all frustrated. He's scratching his head again. He's like,
you know, Pep was frustrated tonight because he didn't look classy on the sideline. He had like an untucked shirt on. It really did
like
look,
his look
all
at
over the
all.
Place.
Like, he had this like long black undershirt on and this like checkered shirt and these like slacks and like these brown shoes. And it's like, it was really not his style. Someone else clearly gave him some advice on how to get dressed for this one, and he shouldn't have followed it. But nevertheless, it looked like Haaland was never going to get past Courtois. He did. Just before half time, he managed to twist his foot into the direction of steering it towards the far post, and it goes in. And in that moment, it's 4-1, and there is a ray of light for Manchester City. It didn't obviously turn out to be enough. Now, again, there was another ray of light for the second half because Courtois doesn't come back out. Lunin comes on for the second half. As I'm sat here right now, I'm not actually sure what the reasoning is for Courtois coming off. But obviously there are ramifications if he has a knock, as Real Madrid play against Atletico Madrid in the derby at the weekend. So we'll wait to see what happens there. But if they thought it was going to be easier, it wasn't. The next chance they had, Lunin makes an unbelievable save. And I was like, oh my God, this is just not going to be Man City's night. And it proved not to be. I mean, they produced a really resilient, proud performance. Kucinov, by the way, had one of his best ever games for Manchester City. He was really good.
Yeah, I thought he was brilliant.
He'll get a lot of plaudits, I think, on the back of this display. Obviously, the night ends up with Vinicius Jr. rounding it off by getting his second of the night, Real Madrid's second of the night, after an unbelievable first-time cross from Tchouaméni. It is so, so nice. The cross is better than the goal. Like, I love it. This is one of my best type of assists out there. A curving first-time pass on the angle in behind the defence for someone to stick home. I absolutely love it. It was the final nail in the coffin. Man City are out, the third season in a row that Madrid have had their number, and the second season in a row that Man City haven't made it to the quarterfinals. I was writing ahead of this game about the narrative that would follow Manchester City and how this was a defining moment for them on and off the pitch. I mean, they've obviously got that Carabao Cup final to come next. Then they have an FA Cup match against Liverpool, which is huge in the context of their season and whether they end up with silverware. And then they go into big Premier League matches against Chelsea and Arsenal to see if they're still in the title race. And at the same time as that, you've now got the narrative that will grow about key personnel at Manchester City and whether they stay. That starts with Pep Guardiola. Will he leave City? Will he decide to leave a year early? We'll have to wait and see. I know on Patreon, you talked the other day about having your doubts because is Pep really going to go on the back of a season when he's won absolutely nothing? You can't believe that he would do that. Erling Haaland, there's talk about Barcelona and Real Madrid potentially coming in for him, particularly Barcelona at the moment. Can they turn his head? He's just signed a really long contract to stay at Man City. You've got the future of Rodri. Real Madrid want to sign Rodri. They're trying to get contracts. What's going with him? Will he be thinking he needs to change up his career now? Phil Foden, Jack, what has happened to Phil Foden? Did not feature in the first leg of this game. And you're thinking, okay, it'll be interesting to see what Pep does with him in the second leg. Again, an unused sub across two games against Real Madrid in a knockout competition. Phil Foden, one of the great game changers in English football, one of the prodigies of English football, nowhere to be seen. City currently beginning talks about a new contract for him, and I think he probably will sign it. But from what I'm told, they're not really willing to hire his wages from what he's been on for the last period of his career.
Surely
we'll have to
not.
Wait to see what happens there. There's all sorts of narratives that are going to open up. Even beyond this, there's been some talk that as many as 10 players could leave Man City at the end of this season. It really is an intriguing situation. And when I'm talking about those players, of course, there's still the likes of James Trafford and John Stones and the likes that don't really matter in the larger context of things. Nathan Ake, these types of players. But then you've still got the likes of Marmoush and maybe Savinho. It's really fascinating. But yeah, losing to Real Madrid in this fashion, not good, but also not a disaster, because I do believe that there are some positives that they can take from this game into the cup final at the weekend.
Yeah, I definitely think that about Manchester City. If you look at actually the performance after the red card, they're 1-0 down. They could capitulate here. They very much didn't. They created a number of chances, you kind of pointed out. I can't remember seeing as many offside goals given in the single game. It must have been four, was it? Where the goals ruled out by the offside flag going up. It really did feel like they just kept coming. For both teams, in fairness, there's a Doku one, there's the Ike Nouri one, there's the Vinny one at the end. Did just feel like everyone kept being ruled out by offsides, and it could have ended sort of 3-3 in many ways, and I wouldn't have been particularly surprised by it. But as it was, I think the right team has progressed over the course of the two legs. That I don't know, there's much debate around that. You know, Real Madrid have kind of outgunned City here and outmaneuvered them in a way that perhaps they didn't think it was going to happen. But if you look at it from a City perspective, I thought that Ryan Cherki had another good game. I thought Doku did well down that left-hand side. Good to see him back in action and making things happen again. And Kusunov, as you say, you know, there are bright sparks in all of this. And I do think the City are finding some solutions, and Pep is finding some solutions, even if this hasn't ended in the way that they would have wanted. He also kind of, around the 70-minute mark, just decided that, you know, enough was enough. They weren't going to be able to claw their way back into this with 10 men and started to rotate the big guns.
That was interesting.
Haaland coming off, Rodri coming off, Diaz coming off. You're like, okay, cool, right? He's thrown in the towel a little bit. He's focusing on the weekend, which is completely understandable. And I think we'll talk about that more over the course of the podcast. But, you know, follow a number of Manchester City accounts, you know, reading their tweets during the game, making sure that kind of across the fan sentiment of it, there wasn't really any anger about this performance. There was a little bit of frustration that if they had got things right in the first leg, this was a tie that might have been there for the taking, but they didn't. But on tonight's performance, I think there's plenty of positives. From a Real Madrid perspective, they've just gone to the Etihad and won, and it continues what has been an excellent streak for Álvaro Arbeloa. Seeing the kind of the payoff of this little system tweak that he's utilized to allow that sort of four midfield is sort of a strikerless system in some ways. Mbappe coming back onto the pitch, it does look from the reports that we've been given after the game that they don't seem to be too worried about Courtois' injury. That they feel it's kind of a muscle overload rather than he's actually strained something. So that's something to be positive about as well. But you actually look at the back line and the way that they acquitted themselves. I thought they were very, very good today. Valverde is just everywhere at the moment. And the fact that Mbappe came on and they played that sort of split striker system to see if it might be able to work with Kylian Mbappe in there on that right-hand side, I thought was notable at this point. And another start, another good performance from Thiago Petarca as well, who is quickly becoming a very, very important piece of this Arbeloa jigsaw. I'm intrigued, I think is probably how I would leave it. But you know, what a period for Real Madrid when it looked like that season was crumbling. And you know, just a couple of weeks ago, post the Benfica game, we're sitting here being like, look, there is no way that this team can win the Champions League playing like this. Well, suddenly they seem to have found some solutions, seem to have worked a few big things out. And we're seeing a team that's starting to pull things together. Again, I still have my question marks over whether when all the big guns come back, if the balance is still able to be there. And defensively today, whilst I think that there were good individual performances, there will still be concern about the amount of chances that City were able to carve out and the amount of saves that Courtois and then Lunin had to make. But the improvements from where they were just 3-4 weeks ago, I think are stark and very clear for everyone to see.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to have to be at their best to get any further. Obviously, it's likely that they'll be playing Bayern Munich in the next round. So that's going to be, that's a huge obstacle for them to try to get over. If you get through that one, though, why not? Why can't it be Real Madrid's year yet again?
Well, you never write them off in this competition fully, do you? Even if things aren't going well, the moment the spring arrives, the clocks go back, et cetera, et cetera. You just know that there is that gear shift that seems to come
Mbappe
most
coming
years.
Back on a sub as well. You got that coming back. You know, you never know.
You do never know. You never know indeed. All right, let's leave that game there and let's go over to Stamford Bridge. Chelsea 0, PSG 3, which means it was 8-2. To PSG over the course of this. And that is the equaling of Chelsea's heaviest ever Champions League defeat over two legs. They lost 7-1 on aggregate to Bayern Munich in 2020, which was obviously difficult times for everybody, 2020. But you look at it and think, wow, okay, this is bad. And there are a lot of very, very angry voices at Chelsea. Now, the boos at halftime were one thing, but perhaps the only thing worse than anger is apathy. And by 65 minutes after this third goal goes in, the bridge is half empty, like genuinely half empty. People are streaming through the exits. And, you know, I have friends at this game who are on the train. You know, they were literally at places, they were at Fulham Broadway on District Lines by the time the game had got to 65 minutes. And I think that tells you everything that you need to know. After that initial kind of uptick in results under Liam Rosenia, this was the nadir in so many ways. And the performance today was shambolic. The setup was completely shambolic. And what they put together on the pitch was atrocious. Now, it is worth pointing out that Chelsea very much were in this tie for 60, 70 minutes of that first leg. Then they give away a goal, but even at 3-2 down, you're thinking, okay, this has been a pretty even contest. You get back to the bridge with a goal deficit and you're still very much in this, right? Because Chelsea had matched up, I thought, in Paris and they'd played really, really well. Now, tonight, obviously that had changed. And the fact that there was a 3-goal deficit going into it, I spoke to Liam Toomey from The Athletic earlier today, and he was like, I think this is irreparable. I don't think that there is a world where Chelsea are able to pull this back against a team with PSG's attacking quality. Because not that Chelsea couldn't score 3 goals, but there was no way that they weren't going to concede. And when you saw the lineup for this one, Dean, it was confusing to begin with because you're like, how is that actually shaking out? You know, we saw this back line of Cucurella, Jurel Hato, Trevor Chalobah and Mamadou Sarr. And I suppose most people would have assumed it was going to be Chalobah at right back, Sarr at centre back alongside Hato with Cucurella at left back. Now, there have been plenty of calls for Wesley Fofana to be dropped right after the weekend and what he put together in that performance against Newcastle, which is understandable. And I think that you can talk about that and say, okay, they needed a little bit more experience in there, fine. But most of the Chelsea fans I know were like, I don't really want to see Wesley Fofana start in this game because of his lack of interest, it seemed, in that game against Newcastle at the weekend. When it actually shook out on the pitch, it looked a little bit more like a back three of Sarr on the right, Chalobah in the middle, Hato on the left, with Cucurella as left wing back and Pedro Neto playing as the right wing back. Now, It's worth pointing out, Reece James obviously picked up an injury. Malagusto currently sick, so they don't have any natural right backs. Although Josh Atchampong has filled in as part of a flat back four on the right for much of this campaign and is no more inexperienced than Mamadou Sarr is at this level, is probably what I would say. So the fact that they didn't turn to him at that moment is a little bit worrying for Chelsea fans. But you could sort of see the, you know, we just talked about fan sentiment with Manchester City. The fan sentiment at Chelsea has absolutely turned and gone through the floor in recent weeks. I saw Nini on Twitter saying, "I'm just tired of this football we play. It's forever the most obvious pass. Once you stop us scoring in transition or from set pieces, we do absolutely nothing." And my friend Henry just texted me. He was at the game. And he just said, quote me. He said, "Three generations of Chelsea, my granddad, a Battersea boy, running down the lads, down in his van to the shed. My dad as well. But I'm completely done with this club and I'm not going to go again until Clear Lake leave." And you can quote me on that. Like, that is the level we're talking about with the apathy, the disinterest, the frustration around the football club. And look, obviously heads are hot after a loss like this. And the way that they concede the three goals, all of them are shambolic within their own right. For the first goal, a long punt downfield from Safonov. Sarr gets it mixed up underneath his feet. Barrett Skelly goes, "Thank you very much," and slots it home. The second goal involves Moises Caicedo and Andre Santos running into each other in the middle of the park. PSG nick it, break down the right. It's pulled back and Barkala scores a screamer. And then the third goal in the second half, Senimiulu curls in a beauty, but it comes after a challenge on the edge of the box and nobody is picking up the second ball whatsoever. And again, Liam Rossini does something similar in some ways to Pep Guardiola. He takes off João Pedro, Cole Palmer and Enzo Fernandez on 60 minutes. And you're going, right, well, he's thinking about Everton at the weekend, which again, I can accept at that point. There is no way you're making up a 6-goal deficit against PSG at that point, right? Like, it doesn't matter how good you are. This is a team that can kill you on the counter, kill you in transition. If you have to go hell for leather to try and score that amount of goals, even if that was possible, you're not going to do it without conceding yourselves. So it's fair enough that managers are kind of just like, okay. And to be honest, I think if you'd offered him at halftime the chance to shake hands and be like, "Just call the tie there," I think he would have taken it. I think a lot of Chelsea fans would have taken it as well. But this was an opportunity, not necessarily to turn things around, but to turn the mood around. If they'd won by a single goal tonight, even if they put together a very spirited draw, I think it would have changed the outlook around where Chelsea have been, especially given the defeat to Newcastle at the Bridge, which is something that just doesn't happen very often, you know, at the weekend. I think that if there had been something to latch onto, it would have given people a little bit of hope. As it is, it just feels like everyone associated with Chelsea that I know is looking at the football club and going, "I don't know what this is. I don't know what it's trying to be." And every pundit in the world is saying, "They're so young. They're so inexperienced. They're going to need to bring in some more experienced players." And yes, that's true. But it's also been true for ages. And look, the team that won the Champions League, 5 years ago, is completely unrecognizable. They've spent £1 billion in that time. And the team has got significantly worse. That significantly worse in terms of the sum of its parts, significantly worse in terms of the way that it's run. And yes, teams go through ups and downs. And I don't think it's necessarily always fair to draw comparisons, but it felt like at that moment, there was something there for fans to cling on to. And in that 5 years, it's been almost systematically eradicated in terms of things that Chelsea fans can look to and hope for. And I think that whilst there was genuine promise in the opening bit of Liam Rossini's career, the fact that he was being memed, the fact that he was saying things in press conferences that people found amusing from the start is okay when you're winning. But as soon as it stops and the sentiment turns against you, you're going to be relentlessly mocked. And that is the last thing on earth this team, which is young, which is inexperienced, which is fragile to such an extent, needs is to be getting headline after headline after headline and it all being negative. And look, it just feels like Chelsea are in a complete tailspin.
Yeah, I mean, 2 months into the job, the honeymoon period definitely over for Rossini. Sadly for Clear Lake, they gave him a 6-year contract until 2032 when they took him over from Strasbourg. We all knew he was inexperienced. We know in head coach terms, he's young, 41. But this is what Clear Lake is, this is what Blue Co is, whatever. Like, what how do the players now continue to believe in this project? It's like every year it gets shown up for what it is, which is naive. The team always looks vulnerable. The team form setup often erratic in terms of what they're picking on a consistent basis. What you're seeing on the pitch is rubbish. One of my mates, Chelsea fan, texted me. He said, did you just see the first goal? Kids get coached the basics of defending, which is pressure, then cover and balance. Absolutely non-existent from Chelsea, and Chalobah was miles away. Likewise, like my mates were at the game, most of them left after the third goal went in. They just don't care anymore about this team. So I've seen so many Chelsea fans talking about the fact, like, for the first time in my life, I'm considering giving up my season ticket. Of course, the reason you don't really end up giving up a season ticket is because of the hope that this ends soon, the hope that Egbali does leave, the hope that you get your club back and that they're starting to be formed into something you recognise and can relate to. But if you're looking at Enzo Fernandez, if you're looking at Cole Palmer right now, maybe even Moises Caicedo, although there hasn't been any real links for him right now, like how and why do these players continue to stay at Chelsea? Like, these are players who have the potential to win the very best trophies in the game and should be at a club level doing that. And they're going to go to the World Cup this summer. You know, Enzo Fernandez will be going there trying to win it. I mean, Cole Palmer, let's see what his role is at England at the moment, what England look like, I don't know. But it's going to happen a lot throughout football anyway, that this World Cup has an impact on how players view their own club careers. And I feel Chelsea are in a really fragile moment, because not only are they needing players like a goalkeeper and a centre-back and a striker, but they might end up losing at least one of their crown jewels, which they can't afford to happen.
I think the other thing is that it feels relentless how much this cycle eats itself up. Right, because it was only last summer that Chelsea felt like the trajectory was really positive. You know, they go and win the Conference League, which they're expected to, but then they go and win the Club World Cup. They qualify for the Champions League on the final day of the season. And you're thinking, okay, from a little bit of a rocky patch that took place in sort of January, February, they've turned that round really nicely, and they've gone on and won a trophy against the reigning European champions that's allowed them to put, you know, a Champions of the World banner above the stadium. Now, you can make of that whatever you will, but it's a factual statement. They have gone and won the Club World Cup. And since then, it has chewed itself up and spat itself out again, to the point where Chelsea feel like they were in a worse spot than they were in February last year, which is wild considering what's been achieved in that time. So it's even like when the trajectory does feel like it's going upwards, and when they do finally feel like there is something to cling on to, that they're on a pathway towards where they want to be, the whole thing kind of spits itself out again, and you're back in the same position.
Mate, so while you were talking there, I got thinking about the Club World Cup and, like, what did that actually do to Chelsea Football Club and people that are linked to the club? Now, I think the fans were a bit tongue-in-cheek about the whole world champion thing, right?
Oh, 100%. 100%.
But I don't think that's the case for the people within the club. I think that there are people within Chelsea that kind of bought into it. And I just looked up, right, what is a false sense of grandeur, right? And it's basically an inflated self-image that doesn't match reality. And there are a few ways that it can show up. Thinking you're uniquely gifted or destined for greatness despite little experience or results. Chelsea. Believing normal rules don't apply to you. Chelsea. Expecting special treatment or admiration from others. Chelsea. Overestimating your influence, intelligence or success. It's all Chelsea, mate. This is exactly what it is.
I would say it's all clear, Lake.
Not just clear, like, because it seeps in to Liam Rossignol. Liam Rossignol even matches some of those traits after 2 months.
I meant, and I didn't think I'd be doing this today, going to bat for the fan base.
Yeah, the fan base is fine. I'm not digging out the fan base. I'm saying the fan base have been, I understand putting up a banner saying Champions of the World. That's fine, right? And you can buy into that because it's a laugh.
We don't truly
believe that you're the best team in the world, right? And you now know it because you've just been battered 8-2 by the best team in the world. But, like, Liam Rossignol has to fit a certain profile for the hierarchy to give him that job and to stay in that job. So he starts saying things and doing things he probably doesn't even believe in. The stupid huddles, the stupid sayings. It's all a load of nonsense. So, yeah, I mean, I think this is where Chelsea are now. In hindsight, I think the Club World Cup success turned out to be a moment that actually wasn't good for them this season.
A false dawn, if you will, perhaps, for people to buy into. Just a word on PSG before we take a little break and move to the other two games, because they have not been quite the side that we saw towards the back end of last season. We know that they've been prone to bouts of slight complacency, it feels like, on the pitch. We've seen some bizarre results and bizarre performances from them. But when they are in full flow in attacking mode, as they were at parts tonight, and look, again, Chelsea did make it relatively easy for them, so therefore you've got to take it all with a pinch of salt. But I lavished praise on Bayern Munich last week for the way that they dismantled Atalanta, despite the fact that Atalanta did leave gaps for them to exploit. So I think we should be looking at the same kind of discussion around PSG. And when they are on song, this front three are nigh on impossible to stop. Now, some of the goals tonight are handed to them, as we kind of alluded to. But even still, the way that they broke away, the way that they stand up a man, the runners into the box, the amount that they flood forward at these moments, the fullbacks bombing on. There's a moment in the first half where Nuno Mendes is trying to get on the end of a long ball over the top of the centre-back from left-back. The positional kind of fluidity that they're able to put together. And look, I think they are quite knackered. I think they have been, you know, overrun by injuries over the course of much of this season. But it does feel to me that in the Champions League, as these spaces open up, and it's something I want to talk about a little bit with Arsenal in a second, but when these games are a bit more open, when teams have to go at each other a little bit more, it does feel like that just suits the way that PSG play. And right now, I'm looking at it and thinking, okay, if they're going to go through the gears, it's still going to take something remarkable to be able to stop this front line when it's in full flow, and especially if you've got Vitinha pulling the strings behind you.
Yeah, look, we're into the big boys league now in terms of the Champions League, right? This is when your real ballers stand up and the endurance shows up too. So, you know, you can pretend up to a certain stage, but then you start to fall away. And that's why the likes of Chelsea are getting their comeuppance right now. Sadly, in a minute, you're going to talk about Bodo Glimt, and there's just a quality gap. There's a mentality gap, and ultimately it all catches up with you as you get to this phase because, yeah, this is when the results matter, man.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, look, PSG also have glue guy Fabian Ruiz to return very shortly. So that's another string to the bow that they're about to add back into this side. And look, again, if they play like this, they're very, very difficult to stop.
Yeah, so, look, Galatasaray and Liverpool play each other on Wednesday and the outcome for either of them, whoever wins, isn't great because you've got to go and play in Paris.
Yeah, 100%. And I think for one side, it doesn't really feel quite as, you know, I think for a lot of teams, when they go back home for a second leg, you're thinking, okay, you know, that's going to be an incredibly difficult place. And this isn't to kind of talk down any of the glamour or the atmosphere or what a stadium can do. But I feel like PSG are just as comfortable away from home as they are at home. And that's an incredible feather in their cap in so many ways. Right, let's take a little break there. When we come back on the other side, we're going to talk about Arsenal and we're going to talk about that incredible game between Sporting and Bodo Glimt as well. Make sure you stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back to Champions League Takeaway here on Ranks FC. Jack Collins and Dean Jones working through all of Tuesday's second legs from the round of 16. We've spoken about Real Madrid's massive win over Manchester City. We've spoken about PSG's massive win over Chelsea. Let's talk about Arsenal because they are the first Premier League side to make it through to the quarterfinals. They might be the only Premier League side from the six in the round of 16 that make it through to the quarterfinals. That is still up in the air for the time being, but the only one there for now, a 2-0 win against Bayer Leverkusen, Dean, that saw them win 3-1 on aggregate. And to me, watching this one, it just felt like Arsenal was so much more expansive. And we've seen this in Europe before, although their first leg against Leverkusen was a little bit attritional, a little bit testy. But the fact that they were able to open up here, I wonder if part of it is to do with the kind of release of emotion that took place at the Emirates at the weekend. But also, this competition seems to be getting a little bit more out of Arsenal in terms of the way that they're able to be a little bit more fluid.
Yeah, I mean, I never felt that Arsenal weren't going to get through this tie from the early stages. I mean, Leverkusen definitely had some good periods. They were definitely competitive for most of the game. But ultimately, it just felt like Arsenal had a sense of control, even though actually, when you look back at the stats, it's one of those games when Arsenal do give away dominance in terms of possession. So Leverkusen had 58% of the ball, but we know from recent games that it doesn't really matter to Arsenal. Some games when they're not dominating the ball. We saw it when they played against Brighton away. They got the 1-0 win. That day, Brighton had 60% possession. Arsenal beat Chelsea 2-1. That was a day when Chelsea had 59% of the ball. Arsenal, obviously, we know that they make games count through making the most of their moments and all the corners and all of that stuff. But this wasn't actually one of those days. This is one of the days when everything came together for different reasons, and it was different strengths within the squad makeup that I feel truly stood out. I think Hincapié was brilliant again. I think Hincapié has been a sensational signing. Ironically, on loan from Bayer Leverkusen right now. But he was great. Obviously, we've seen him domestically make his mark recently. Just such a good player to have within the squad. So versatile, so trustworthy. He was great. And then Eze comes forward and scores the first goal. Great finish. A great finish from Eze to put Arsenal in command of the tie. And from that moment, you were like, okay, so when's the second coming? When's the second coming? How's it going to come? And ultimately, it's Declan Rice that does end up deciding it with a brilliant finish. A perfectly guided, driven shot, which is something that we're going to be seeing way more of over the next couple of years, and obviously has started to become more of his game in the past 2 years. And it allowed Arsenal to just complete a comfortable win. They could have had a third as well. Kai Havertz had the ball in the back of the net, but he'd done so with his arm. That was slightly unfortunate for Victor Gyökeres because he'd done some great work to get the ball into the box. Literally, I was like, oh, that was brilliant as Gyökeres chipped it in. And unfortunately, it was the right call, but the goal was ruled out. I just feel like Arsenal continue to have something special about them, mate. And while people will continue to laugh at this, I don't see why they can't win the quadruple. Like, I actually don't see why not. Because the Premier League is theirs for the taking right now. At the weekend, the Carabao Cup, they are favourites. Then they go into the FA Cup, where they have a game against Southampton, which would be a huge surprise if they don't progress in that. This could be an absolutely sensational, historic season for Arsenal. And one of the things that I just really like looking at this team right now is this sense of depth that is in there. You know, you talk about being able to make changes halfway through the second half. They did start taking people out. Obviously, Ben White had been given the start. He was taken out for Mosquera. Zubimendi was able to get a 25-minute rest before the cup final. Norgaard went in. Eze picked up a little bit of a knock. Kai Havertz went in there. But ultimately, you know, you haven't even had to use Madueke. You've got Max Dowman on there. You've got Gabriel Jesus there. You've got Calafiori on the bench. I just really like it, mate. And at the moment, I started off by saying this to kind of incite people probably, but I'm starting to believe my own hype here, mate. I'm starting to believe that Arsenal do actually make it to the Champions League final. And obviously, once you get to that stage, you don't know if they're actually going to go and win it. But if they get to the final and they win it 1-0 with a set piece, then actually isn't going to surprise me.
Yeah, I mean, look, I still don't think Arsenal are going to win a quadruple.
But why? Mostly because, what's your reason? What's your actual reason?
Well,
Tell me where they lose.
I think Bayern beat them.
In the final?
I mean, I think Bayern beat them. I think there's a decent chance the PSG could beat them. Like, it's... I think that it's still one of those. It's not to say it can't happen. I just think that competing on four fronts is something that, you know, teams have struggled with for many, many years, right? Like, especially there's a reason it's never been done from a Premier League perspective. So look, I'm not saying it can't happen. I just think it remains unlikely at this point.
I mean, look, they've got Sporting in the quarterfinal for context, right? They've got that's as good a draw as you could hope for. Like, I'm not saying deal, and I'm not saying like they'll be assuming that they're already through, but I just feel like the pathway is really nice for them, and just got a lot of belief in them, mate, to be honest with you. And I haven't heard a good enough argument about why they can't do it. Like, yeah, of course they could lose to someone. I'm not saying that it's impossible, but I'm like,
I know, but like, also, I felt like this about Pep City team in their pomp. They obviously won the treble, which was an incredible feat in its own right. But I was also like, you know, I didn't see who was going to beat them at any point. And yet, you know, teams did, because they didn't win a quadruple. And so
it's good that there's no pressure on them, because all that really matters to Arsenal is winning the league this season, right? Like, that is the most important thing. So they've got four trophies to go for, and they are in the rare situation whereby winning one of them, as long as it's the league, is actually enough. Like, that is major success for them and a major step forward in this project under Arteta. So that helps, and they will absolutely disregard. And if I was a journalist at the game right now, no, I wouldn't have the balls to sit there and ask Arteta about the quadruple and be laughed at and then see the video go around. But I don't think it's unreasonable to talk about it. I really don't.
I don't think it's unreasonable to talk about it at all. I just still think it's...
Sometimes I really do.
I don't think it's unreasonable. I think it is one of those things that you can look at and say, yeah, I mean, and also the other thing is, I think you can fairly say that Arsenal stand a relatively good chance of winning each competition that they're in, right? That is fine. It's just when you add... It's a bit like an accumulator, right? Even if you have two things that are odds on and two things that are 2-1, let's just say, you know, by the time you add them all together, it becomes 10-1, right? Like that's how it works with accumulating odds. It feels similar to me in terms of when you're talking about stacking up trophies. Like, the more you add to it, the more improbable it becomes. Obviously, that's the nature of the beast. But I just feel like it's perfectly reasonable to talk about it. I just still don't. I don't buy into it enough. And it's not really anything to do with this Arsenal side, to be honest. It's just, I just feel like it's a very, very difficult thing to do, especially in the Premier League when it's this attritional every single weekend. And that's something that they're going to have to grind out. I imagine that starts to take it out of you after a while. And anyway, look, we might not be having this conversation by the time we get round to the next Champions League round, because they might have lost the Carabao Cup final. So,
they might have, but as we sit here right now, they are favourites to win all four competitions. And that's pretty unbelievable, really. And not many people would have thought at the start of the year that we'd be sitting here mid-March saying that Arsenal were favourites to win all four competitions that they're in.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair enough. I mean, look, just a couple of other things. I thought Zubimendi was excellent today. Like, I thought the way that he swept up at the back. I mean, he is always excellent. And look, I think that there have been some frustrations around some of the moments that have been around him, with a couple of loose passes, etc., that have led to Arsenal conceding goals in relatively important games. But on the whole, the way he has adapted to life within this team and just settled in and become such a key part of it was really, really impressive. The Eze goal... It's outrageous how hard he hits that ball. Like, and a lovely moment for him to get his first Champions League goal. What a goal to score to get that. And I thought the influence of Ben White down that right-hand side really did free up Bukayo Saka to have one of the best games he's had in a little while as well. So look, some combinations coming back in. There was a discussion about who was going to play where today for Arsenal, that when Urien Timber was determined to be out. I was like, if they play Ben White, they should play Saka down that side. If they play Mosquera, perhaps they should play Noni Madueke down that side and change it up a little bit. But it worked beautifully. And seeing those two back in combination was a really nice element to add to this as well. But yeah, relatively comfortable from Arsenal, I thought. There was less of the kind of fits that I thought that they had in the game in the away leg, where Christian Cafarné did a brilliant job of unsettling Saliba and Gabriel. Just didn't feel like Leverkusen had loads and loads to throw at Arsenal today. And by the time the second goal went in, it did kind of feel like this one was done and dusted. Credit to Leverkusen, though, because They didn't really give up on it. They continued to play their football. They continued to flood forward. They had a lot of the ball, as you mentioned, right at the top. It was still a very good performance from a side that has been up and down this year. Absolutely no shame for them in the way that they've gone about these two legs and ended up on the wrong side of this one.
Oh, no, absolutely, mate. And they can definitely hold their heads high. I think there'll probably be a sense of frustration. They didn't get a goal to give themselves a lifeline in this one, but there's absolutely no shame in the performance they've put up two legs and, you know, made Arsenal sweat for their place.
Yeah, 100%. And given the fact that they had that game against Bayern at the weekend as well, that's a tough run of fixtures for Leverkusen. They can attack the rest of this season, I think, with a real kind of dynamism now after they've given a very, very good account of themselves. All right, let's go to the big one, shall we? Let's finish on a high. Sporting 5, Bodo Glimt 0 after extra time. 3-0 to Sporting on the 90-minute mark. And in extra time, they score 2 goals. The first to give them the lead and the second to seal the deal right at the end of this one. And look, last week, I said you would struggle to find a more complete performance than the way that Bodo Glimt dismantled Sporting in their home leg. Well, I tell you, here's one. This was just absolutely exceptional. And look, sometimes at the end of a fairy tale run, you know, it's easy to feel really disheartened at the end of it, right? I don't think this is the case here. I remember when Ajax were knocked out in 2019 and genuinely being like heartbroken by sitting there absolutely devastated with the outcome. And it was no shade on Tottenham. They had an incredible moment themselves, but I just wanted to see that Ajax team go on and on and on. And I felt quite similarly about this Bodo Glimt team, although obviously I do have a soft spot here for Sporting and the Primeira sides. And they're the first side into the quarterfinals from Portugal for a little while, which is nice to see from a Primeira perspective. But I tell you what, if the first one was a coaching masterclass from Kjetil Knudsen, this was an absolute masterclass in reverse from Højbjerg, who made all of the necessary changes in order to turn this game on its head. Now, I think that we see these games and we saw Manchester City chasing a three-goal deficit. We saw Chelsea chasing a three-goal deficit, both of them at home for these second legs. And okay, the opposition's different. They're both coming up against the last two champions of Europe. And sometimes you've got to go, okay, quality tells. But considering the way that Bodo had played away at Atleti, the way that they'd played away at Inter, and they took apart some very, very talented sides, this was not light work by any stretch of the imagination. But Borges made some really interesting changes. He brought in Eduardo Quaresma in the middle for Ousmane Diamande. He brought in Maxi Araujo coming back from suspension for Georgios Vaginidis. And then he moved Fresneda from left back, where he'd been torn apart last week in the Arctic Circle, to his preferred right back slot. He brought back Pedro Gonçalves, again returning from suspension, replacing Luis Guilherme, who was very ineffective last week. And then he brought back Hidemasi Morita into the engine room to replace young João Tomás, who's having a very good season. But Morita just has that little bit of bite, that little bit of experience. And those changes made a massive difference, because what they did this time around that they hadn't done last time, we've talked about this before with Bodo, but they defend the width of their box incredibly well and they let you get into the channels. Well, Sporting took such advantage of that. And so much of this was Maxi Araujo at left back, who was absolutely sensational. Now, he should have had an assist after about 3 minutes, because he stands one up and Trincao heads it over the bar, when he really, really should hit the target. But actually, the way that they overloaded on that left-hand side, the variations in those spaces in order to bring a player over, whether that was Luis Suarez up front or whether it was Pedro Gonçalves dropping into those spaces, whether it was Trincao coming across to add an extra body, the way that they moved Bodo Glimt around was actually kind of eerily reminiscent of what Bodo Glimt had done to them at points in the first leg. And they just hit them with wave after wave after wave of pressure. And look, there were opportunities at the other end. Bodo hit the woodwork at one point. There were a couple of moments where, you know, that a goal would have changed the tie and swung it back in their favour. Actually, the way that this was managed from a Sporting perspective, you know, they knew that they needed maybe not an early goal, but something to ignite the crowd. They give them that in terms of the performance. And then about 10 minutes before halftime, they get the breakthrough they're looking for when Gonçalo Inácio rises highest from a corner and heads it in. It's 1-0 at the break. And you're thinking, okay, There's still a long way to go here, but what they have done is manage this game beautifully. And it's something that obviously we see in the Manchester City and the Chelsea games. They just completely failed to do. Manage the situation and make sure that they are the side in the complete ascendancy. And it doesn't feel like an outball. It doesn't feel like there's these, you know, anything more than just individual moments that are going to change the game. And then what you see in the second half is he starts to make changes from the bench that really do open up the game. Zeno De Bast comes on. And changing your centre back is not necessarily the thing that often, you know, changes the dynamic of the game. But the way that De Bast sprays balls around the pitch means that they were able to get wide, to stretch the areas and to force Birdo into defending spaces that they didn't really want to defend. Braganza was excellent in conjunction because he added a little bit more energy to that midfield, but a little bit more of forward thinkingness than Hidemasa Morita had done. Morita was there in the first half to make sure that there weren't going to be counterattacks and they weren't going to get stung. But as they start searching for the second and then the third goal, and then the goals that obviously win him it, Braganza is really, really crucial to the way that Sporting start to just take a chokehold in the second half of where Birdo glimpsed they're at. And his influence on the game grew and grew and grew through extra time to the point where he was very, very integral to how things changed. And when you kind of bring on Nuno Santos, who's just come back from a really long-term injury, he's been out for a while, he hits the post where it's when it's 3-3. And you're like, oh, okay, that might have been the moment. But he just continued to push them forward in those wide left areas that they'd been exploiting all night. And I just thought it was really, really impressive the way that they were able to stretch Birdo, which, you know, teams have not been able to do. Think about Inter, right? Who play with wide, with full wingbacks and weren't able to find joy in those channels. Sporting showed them how tonight. And that's with a flat back four, right? But their left back is pinned up against the Birdo right back in order to exploit those situations and create those overloads. So there are a couple of moments here which are a little bit controversial. The penalty which leads to Sporting's equaliser, which is converted by Luis Suarez, is, as far as I'm concerned, not a penalty. But there's a moment, I think, which is frustrating. And I know that in Europe, the rules are a little bit different, because you're looking at it and saying, okay, if the ball touches the arm in the area, it comes off his chest and then hits his hand on the way out. In the Premier League, that's not given. In Europe, it is. But there's a moment for Birdo as well in extra time where something very similar happens with Morten Hjulmand, and it's not even looked at. And we talk about consistency, right? I think that Sporting were far and away the better side here, right? Like, I feel like they absolutely deserve to turn this around. The way that they controlled this, the way that the Alvalade whipped up this storm inside the stadium that they took full advantage of, should all be given complete credit. And as I say, Højbjerg, who was questioned after that first leg defeat, who's been questioned at points this season because he's behind Farioli's Porto in the race for the title, This was a marker of being like, no. I've taken this side from where they were under Amorim, which was a wonderful side, right? In that 3-4-2-1. And I have turned them into a more ball dominant 4-2-3-1, which allows more of these players to showcase what they're capable of doing. I've built on the foundations that were put in there, and I've taken them to another level in terms of what they are capable of producing. That's 15 wins from their last 16 home games. The Alvalade is an absolute fortress. And look, I didn't think that they would have enough to be able to turn over a 3-goal deficit without conceding, considering how good Birdo Glimt have been on the break all the way through this competition, or at least in the last 5 games in particular, although I think there was a strength even before that. But you look at it and you watch this, and every single situation that could arise is thought of. There are solutions everywhere on the pitch for Sporting. And you speak about it, and look, I totally agree with you that if, you know, any side in the competition was going to pick who they get in the last eight with the teams that we assume are going to get there, most teams would still be picking Sporting. And I take that from an Arsenal perspective. But going to the Alvalade is no joke whatsoever. And this is a side that have the capability to really hurt anyone. Over two legs, the second leg away from home, sure. I'm not saying that we're going to see them in the semi-finals. But this performance, and afterwards, Højbjerg said, he said a funny thing. He said, we saw the best version of Birdo Glimt in the first leg, but they didn't know what the best version of Sporting looked like. And I do think that was an interesting quote in terms of, yeah, you know, not holding it back. And I'm not suggesting that they held back on purpose and lost on purpose. Those things are not true. But he was like really disappointed with the way that they went about their business. But he also knew what he was coming up against. And I think he was able to kind of unleash this torrent on a Bodø/Glimt side that just didn't have any of the answers for these unrelenting waves of green and white pressure.
It was weird. In the second half, once they were 2-0 down, I've never really specifically thought this before when I'm watching a game, but I was watching the Bodø players and the way that they were like moving in the pitch and the way that they looked on the pitch. And I was like, they look like they're drowning. Like the pitch looked too big for them. Like they was like they were treading water in terms of how can we survive out here?
And this happened to Chelsea too tonight. Like exactly the same thing. They looked like they were running through treacle.
It was odd. And I guess for them, it was a very difficult situation to manage once they were 2-0 down, because you've just got to survive. There's no way you're going to thrive in that sort of under that pressure. Look, what tells me everything about Bodø's night. So the player that played the most passes for Bodø tonight was the goalkeeper, right?
100%.
He made 58 passes, right? The outfield player, as one of the defenders, right, made 44 passes. And that was the highest outfield number that you get from Bodø/Glimt tonight. You flip that over to Sporting, 8 of their players made more passes than that. 8 of their players. Like, they were just absolutely overwhelmed by the occasion. And Sporting, it was like, you know, it was like they just put their foot down, and Bodø were just like, they did well, to be honest, to get through the 90, because I think Sporting will be a little bit disappointed they couldn't get that fourth goal by the end of the 90. There was just no way they could survive another half hour of it. But look, they've got to remember what they've achieved across this season, and they'll be one of the memorable stories of this campaign. You know, we'll remember them more than we remember some of the bigger teams from the tournament this season.
I mean, look, it's been incredible. And I said before this tie even kind of set up that these were my two favorite stories, right? That Sporting's rise to being in the top seven had been majorly undercooked in terms of what it was. Now, I bought into the Bodø/Glimt fairy tale, and I will make absolutely no apologies for that, right? I'd like to apologize to absolutely nobody for falling in love with an underdog and talking about them in the way that we did, because they were joy and they were an absolute joy to behold. But so was Sporting tonight. And as I said at the top, there's a reason that I'm not sitting here feeling devastated about the fact that the underdog's tale has come to an end. There's no, I feel like pure shit, just want Bodø/Glimt back in the same way that there was about that Ajax team. What we're seeing here is them being overdone by another incredible footballing story that's taking place in Lisbon, and what Rui Borges has done here, you know, with this side in general. You know, was brought in there in a very difficult period to follow João Pereira, who just had fallen flat on his face in trying to continue the legacy was there, and turn them into league champions, who then won the Portuguese Cup, the Taça de Portugal, and then at this point has taken them further in Europe than any coach has for an absolute multitude of years. Deserves all the credit in the world, and Sporting do as well. It felt like an avalanche at the Alvalade tonight. And that for me is the mark of a side who have complete faith in what they're doing. We've talked about a lot of teams today who don't have that faith. There isn't that unity between fan base and players and manager, that synergy that you can work towards. And look, it's an incredible story in its own right that they've made the last 8. And that first leg against Arsenal in Lisbon, I think is going to be very, very interesting indeed. Especially, you know, as has been pointed out, it wasn't too long since these two clashed in this stadium in the first place. And we will keep an eye on what happens. Maybe Pedro Gonçalves is going to score from the halfway line again. Mm-hmm. Who knows? Who knows in this one? But I think with that, it's probably time for us to bring Champions League Takeaway to a close. All there's left for me to do, say a massive thank you to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been Champions League Takeaway here on Ranks FC. We'll be back tomorrow to deal with all of the action from Wednesday night's second legs of the round of 16, as we find out who the other 4 quarterfinalists are going to be. So make sure you're locked in for that one here on Ranks FC. But for now, Ranks Squad, thank you for listening, and we'll see you very shortly. Take it easy. Peace.